fear not. To fear anything is to believe that you are separate from God. You and your Father are inseparable. Your greatest challenge in life is to accept this truth and live it every day. Know that love and peace are your birthright. When this thought pattern begins to dominate your consciousness, then and only then are you free to experience total peace. Peace that passes all understanding.
Peace that passes all understanding. These and other concepts are beautifully illustrated and explained in a book entitled The Sermon on the Mount. It continues to be a bestseller since its first publication in 1934, and the author is Dr. Emmett Fox. This tape is designed to introduce Dr. Fox's philosophy of scientific Christianity, as he explained it in The Sermon on the Mount. To those already familiar with the great works of Emmett Fox, this tape will provide another means of enjoying his teachings.
Dr. Fox was born in Ireland, July the 30th, 1886. Although his parents were both Irish, he grew up in England, where his father was a member of Parliament as well as a practicing surgeon. As a young boy, Emmett was recognized by his family as one who could cure headaches by the simple touch of his small hand. As he grew up, this seemingly unique ability to heal led him into the study of metaphysics, and away from the traditional religion of his parents. Referred to as a scholar, teacher, writer, healer, philosopher, and minister, he was also an electrical engineer until a few years before he came to America in 1930. Dr. Fox's religious teachings were headquartered out of the Church of the Healing Christ at Carnegie Hall in New York City for 20 years. It is estimated that 5,000 people attended his weekly sermons. While on vacation in Paris, France, Emmett Fox died of a stroke on August the 13th, 1950. He was deeply missed by the thousands of people who attended his church and the hundreds of thousands all over the world who followed his beliefs through his books and articles. Let's hear more about the philosophy and teachings contained in The Sermon on the Mount.
The Bible is the most precious possession of the human race. It contains the key to life. It shows us how to live so that we may have health, freedom, and prosperity. It meets everyone on his own level and brings him to God. It has a solution for every problem. It is the greatest literary work ever compiled, and by far the most interesting of all books. We will gain even more by reading it with a spiritual key, the key to understanding how to apply the Bible to our daily lives. However, the real value of the Bible lies in the spiritual interpretation. Wonderful as the outer Bible is, it is far less than 1% of the inner Bible, the Bible that is hidden behind the symbols.
The Bible is not primarily intended to teach history or biography or natural science. It is intended to teach psychology and metaphysics. It deals basically with states of mind and the laws of mental activity. Each of the characters in the Bible represent a state of mind that any of us may experience, and the events that happen to the various characters illustrate the consequences of entertaining such states of mind, either good or bad.
Some of the Bible characters, such as Moses, Elijah, and Paul, are historical figures. They were real men who lived on earth and did the deeds attributed to them. But they also represent states of mind at different levels of growth as their lives unfolded. Other Bible characters, such as Adam and Eve, the prodigal son, the Good Samaritan, or the Scarlet Woman, though never having an actual existence, were written to express states of mind, and always in a remarkably simple and graphic manner.
Any text in the Bible can be taken in the past, present, or future, because God is outside of time. The Bible teaches that outer conditions and events are not important in themselves, but only as far as they necessarily express the character or consciousness of the subject.
The Bible is infinitely optimistic. It doesn't say that everything will be all right. Things will not be right unless we make them so, by right thinking. It teaches that negative thoughts and beliefs, especially the sin of limiting God, can bring all kinds of trouble and suffering. Wrong thinking can only bring wrong results.
Wrong thinking can only bring wrong results. This is no get-rich-quick scheme. The Bible teaches that if we have faith in God, He will supply our needs bountifully. Naturally, we can't just order up the life we want just by thinking it so, as though God must obey our commands. Simply willing something to be will not make it happen. For example, metaphysics will not bring money for money's sake. Since we can only see the part of life we are living, involving a short time span, our wishes and desires are not always for the best. What the Bible does teach is that our lives turn out as a result of the thoughts we think. If we have an awareness or consciousness of love, health, and prosperity, it will show in our words and deeds and actions.
Over matter. The Bible teaches that what we see around us, our life, is merely the results of our own thoughts and beliefs. Therefore, we really can't dominate something outside of our minds, but we can change our minds. The Bible doesn't pretend that our troubles are imaginary. Troubles are there for our experience. But the Bible says that experience can be dissolved by realizing the presence of God.
To realize the presence of God means to affirm God's love. God created the universe. He only creates perfection. Therefore, this too shall pass.
We can raise our thoughts to see a perfect world, a world without the particular problems that we currently face. Overcoming our problems is not accomplished by faith healing in the sense of fighting an alleged evil with blind faith and sheer willpower. The Bible teaches an intelligent and understanding faith based on the goodness and all-presence of God. The truth is that God is the only presence and the only power, that He is entirely good, that evil is a false belief about the truth, and that the outer world is the manifestation or result of our own minds.
The Bible teaches that today's prayer can put everything right, if only we won't look back to yesterday. Remember the story of Lot's wife? She turned into a pillar of salt. Salt is a preservative, and in the Bible, this symbolizes the human tendency to hold on to the past and remain chained to old ways of thinking. The Bible teaches us to go forward with new ideas and new aspirations, to new adventures. To quote Dr. Fox,
the study of the Bible is not unlike the search for diamonds. At first, people found a few diamonds in the yellow clay, and they were delighted with their good fortune, even while they supposed that this was the full extent of their find. Then, upon digging deeper, they came upon the blue clay, and to their amazement, they then found as many precious stones in a day as they had previously found in a year, and what had formerly seemed like wealth faded into insignificance beside the new riches. In your exploration of Bible truth, see to it that you do not rest satisfied in the yellow clay of a few spiritual discoveries, but press on to the rich blue clay underneath. The Bible, however, differs from the diamond field in the sublime fact that beneath the blue clay, there is a richer strata, awaiting the touch of spiritual perception on and on to infinity. As you read the Bible, constantly affirm that divine wisdom is enlightening you. That is the way to get direct inspiration.
There are many other key phrases and rich concepts which form the core to Dr. Fox's philosophy. Scientific prayer, also referred to as spiritual treatment, is really the lifting of your consciousness or awareness above the level where you have faced a problem. Raise your consciousness above the problem and let God do the rest. To raise your consciousness, you must positively withdraw your attention from the problem and concentrate gently upon spiritual truth. This can be done by reading the Bible, going over a hymn or poem, or listening to music that helps you, or by using affirmations. An affirmation is a positive statement or thought, such as, God is with me, or God loves me. It's important when using affirmations not to inject any negative energy or feelings. Replace your emotions with positive, loving thoughts. It doesn't matter how you rise above the problem, but you must remove yourself emotionally and experience the peace of God.
True place is a term which means to be with God. To be with God is the ideal place for us all. However, as we are working towards reaching that level, wherever we find ourselves today is our right place. Where we are at any given time, no matter how confused or lost we might feel, is the place where we need to be to learn our next lesson. Spiritual growth cannot be rushed for anyone. When we have learned all there is to learn about a given situation, then we will move on to learn something new, and we will be in our right place once again. By keeping this optimistic outlook, we see that there is nothing that we can do that will not be forgiven. But we must first learn to forgive ourselves. We need simply to affirm and claim our natural birthright to experience God and keep moving forward.
The secret place of the Most High refers to the individual mind. In the privacy of our minds, we can pray to God on a personal level. We can entertain thoughts and ideas that only we and God are aware of. we need not be in church or anywhere in particular to pray to God. Because our thoughts shape our lives, it is imperative that we guard what we think about. If a person lives a prosperous, healthy, fulfilled life, it is obvious that thoughts of prosperity and health are all that are allowed in the secret place of the Most High.
The golden rule for scientific Christianity says that to do unto others as we would have them do in return to us is only part of the task. It is also necessary that we think of others as we would have them think of us. Again, there's so much importance on what takes place in the mind.
The law of life. As we think and act toward others, so shall they respond to us.
Christ is the Lord of karma. Karma, simply stated, means reaping what you sow. Whenever we begin to pray, we can rise above mistakes of the past. Whenever the Christ, meaning the truth about anything, is raised up in prayer, healing results. Sickness, sin, poverty, and confusion, weakness of character, all disappear under the power of the healing Christ. Christ is nothing less than the direct action of God Himself, the self-knowing Spirit. It overrides all else.
Prayer changes things. It alters our character. We are never the same after we have prayed. We help all of mankind with our prayers. A strategy for living is the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer is the most important of all Christian documents. This great prayer is a compact formula for the development of the soul. Those who use it regularly with understanding will experience a real change of soul. And the Bible refers to this change as being born again. Millions of people repeat this prayer daily without fully comprehending its inner meaning. A deeper understanding of the great prayer can literally change one's life.
As you continue to explore the teachings of Emmett Fox and find that his philosophies help you, you may notice positive changes happening to your life. This isn't magic, but the result of your own thoughts and prayers. There is no external power making things better. The magic is your own choice to examine and alter the thoughts that cross your mind and the desire to experience the presence of God.
Throughout his teachings, we are reminded not to become overly intrigued by the study of metaphysics, that is, the study of phenomena which cannot be fully explained or comprehended by the six senses. We must live in the world of the present. Sometimes, we use metaphysics as an escape mechanism and avoid solving the problems that face us in the world in which we live. We should take our growing understanding of the Bible and of God and apply these principles to living joyous, successful lives filled with peace and love.
Here on earth to learn the truth of being. We are here to become self-governed entities, focal points of divine mind, each expressing God in a new way. That is the object of our existence, and the only way to do this is with more knowledge of God. Some individuals may seem to progress more rapidly than others, but the main body of humanity is always steadily growing in the knowledge of God.
Another way to express our purpose on earth is to think of the world as a school, and the two great lessons are that God is absolutely everywhere and the power of thought. We should not be dependent for happiness or self-respect upon human praise or approval. Our attitude should be, I do my duty and enjoy myself wherever I am. I do my job and pass it along to another. I am going to live forever. In 1,000 years from now, I shall still be alive and active somewhere. Always the best is yet to be. Always the future will be better than the present or the past, because I am ever growing and progressing, and I am an immortal soul. I am the master of my fate. I greet the unknown with a cheer and press forward joyously, exulting in the great adventure. Armed with this philosophy and really understanding its power, you have nothing to fear in life or death, because God is all and God is good. The Golden Keys to Successful Living. Christ is easily the most important figure that has ever appeared in the history of mankind. This is true whether you choose to call him God or man, and if man, whether you choose to consider him as the world's greatest prophet and teacher, or merely as a well-intentioned fanatic who came to grief and failure and ruin after a short and stormy public career. However you regard him, the fact will remain that the life and death of Jesus and the teachings attributed to him have influenced the course of human history more than any other man who ever lived, more than Alexander or Caesar, Charlemagne, Napoleon, or Washington. More people's lives are influenced by his doctrines, more books are written and read and bought, more speeches or sermons are made concerning him than all the other names mentioned put together. Jesus has been the religious inspiration of the whole European race throughout the ages, the race that has dominated and molded the destinies of the entire world, culturally and socially as well as politically. This alone entitles him to his premier position in world importance. Therefore, there can hardly be a more important undertaking than to inquire into the question of what Jesus really did stand for.
So what did Jesus teach us? What did he really wish us to believe and to do? What were the objectives that he really had at heart? And how far did he actually succeed in accomplishing these objectives in his life and in his death? How far has the religion or movement called Christianity really expressed or represented his ideas? How far does the Christianity of today present his message to the world? If he came back now, what would he say of the self-styled Christian nations in general, and of the Christian churches in particular? Of the Anglicans, the Baptists, the Catholics, the Greek Orthodox, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, the Quakers, the Salvationists, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Unitarians, and so on? What did Jesus teach?
This is the question that Emmett Fox proceeds to answer in his book, The Sermon on the Mount. He proposes to show that the message Jesus brought has a unique value because it is the truth, and the perfect statement of the truth of the nature of God and of man, of life and the world, and of the relationships which exist between them.
And far more than this, we find that his teaching is not a mere abstract account of the universe, which would be of little more than academic interest, but that it constitutes a practical method for the development of the soul and for the shaping of our lives and destinies into the things that we really wish them to be.
Jesus explains to us what the nature of God is and what our own nature is, tells us the meaning of life and of death, shows us why we make mistakes, why we yield to temptation, why we become sick, impoverished, and old, and how we may bring health, happiness, and true prosperity into our lives and into the lives of others.
The first thing that we have to realize is a fact of fundamental importance, because it means breaking away from all the ordinary prepossessions of Orthodox religion. The plain fact is that Jesus taught no theology whatsoever. His teaching is entirely spiritual or metaphysical. Historical Christianity, unfortunately, has largely concerned itself with theological or doctrinal questions which, strange to say, have no part whatsoever in the gospel teaching. It is startling to learn that all the doctrines and theologies of the churches are human inventions, built up by their authors out of their own mentalities and claimed upon the Bible from the outside. There is absolutely no system of theology or doctrine to be found in the Bible. It simply is not there. People who feel the need of some intellectual explanation of life, and also believe that the Bible is a revelation of God to man, draw the natural conclusion that the one must be within the other, and then proceeded to manufacture the thing that they wish to find. They haven't learned the spiritual or metaphysical key. They aren't operating from the spiritual basis, and consequently they seek a purely intellectual explanation of life. And there can be no such explanation.
The actual explanation of a man's life lies in the fact that we are essentially spiritual and eternal, and that this world and the life we know intellectually is only a cross-section of the full truth, and a cross-section of anything can never furnish even a partial explanation of the whole. Glimpsing one tiny corner of the universe with only half-opened eyes, men built up absurd fables about a limited and a man-like God who conducted his universe much as a rather ignorant and barbarous prince might conduct the affairs of a small kingdom. All sorts of human weaknesses, such as vanity, fickleness, and spite, were attributed to this being. Then, far-fetched and inconsistent legends were built up concerning original sin, infinite punishment for finite transgressions, and the horrible doctrine of predestination to eternal torment. And then, much later, eternal bliss was added. Now, no such theory is taught in the Bible. If it were the object of the Bible to teach it, it would be clearly stated in a straightforward manner in some chapter or other, but it isn't.
The plan of salvation, which figured so prominently in the evangelical sermons and divinity books of a past generation, is as completely unknown to the Bible as it is to the Quran, the Muslim doctrine of faith. There never was any such arrangement in the universe. Therefore, the Bible doesn't teach it at all. What has happened is that certain obscure texts from Genesis, a few phrases taken here and there from Paul's letters, and one or two isolated verses from other parts of the scriptures, have been taken out and pieced together to produce the kind of teaching that seemed proper to be found in the Bible. Jesus says none of this. He is anything but a Pollyanna, as they say, or cheap optimist. He warns us, not once but often, that obstinacy in sin can bring very severe consequences, and that man who parts with the integrity of his soul, even though he gains the whole world, is a tragic fool. But he teaches that we are only punished for and actually punished by our own mistakes, and he teaches that every man and woman, no matter how steeped in evil, always has a direct access to an all-living, all-powerful Father God, who will forgive us and supply his own strength to us and enable us to find ourselves again and again.
Jesus has been sadly misunderstood and misrepresented in other directions. For instance, there is nothing whatever in his teachings for the setting up of any form of any hierarchy of officials or system of ritual. He never proposed any such methods. In fact, the whole tone of his mentality is definitely anti-ecclesiastical. Through his public life, Jesus was at war with the churchgoers and religious officials of his own country. They first hindered, then persecuted him, and with a perfectly sound instinct of self-preservation, they felt that the truth, as he taught it, was the beginning of the end for them. And they finally had him put to death.
It seems that human nature is very prone to believe what it wants to believe, rather than reading the scriptures with an open mind. Perfectly sincere men have appointed themselves Christian leaders with the most imposing and pretentious titles, and then clothe themselves in elaborate and gorgeous vestments to impress people, in spite of the fact that their master, in the plainest language, strictly charged his followers that they must do nothing of the kind. According to Matthew, chapter 23, verse 8, "But be ye not called rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ, and all ye are brethren." And he denounced the Pharisees as hypocrites, because they love the chief seats and bind heavy burdens grievous to be borne, signifying their rules and regulations. Jesus made a special point of discouraging any emphasis on outer observances or upon hard and fast rules and regulations of any kind. What he taught was a certain spirit in one's conduct and attitude, and he was careful to teach principles only, knowing that when spirit is right, details will take care of themselves, and in fact, the letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life. Yet in spite of this, the history of Orthodox Christianity is largely made up of attempts to enforce all sorts of external observances on the people. The Puritans attempted to enforce the Old Testament Sabbath, which was a Hebrew ordinance applied exclusively to the desecration of Saturday. Jesus particularly discouraged any Sabbath observance, saying that the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath, and made a point of doing anything he wanted on that day. He clearly indicates throughout his teaching that the time has come when man must make each and every day a spiritual Sabbath by knowing and doing all things in a spiritual light.
There are Christians who do realize that there is no system of theology in the Bible, unless one likes to put it there deliberately, and have practically given up religion altogether, but still cling to Christianity because they feel intuitively that it is the truth. There is really no logical justification for their attitude, since they don't possess the spiritual key which makes the teachings of Jesus intelligible. It's most confusing to those who have neither the blind faith of orthodoxy nor the spiritual interpretation of scientific Christianity to support them.
It's easy to be enthralled by the beauty and mystery of the Gospels, but in the absence of the spiritual key, common sense and all the scientific knowledge of mankind challenges what these Gospels contain. Miracles are a good example. But if the miracles didn't really happen, then does the rest of the Gospel story lose all real significance? Jesus believed miracles to be possible and performed them, as he believed and taught many things in contradiction to rational philosophy. He had no interest in superstitious beliefs, because what really interested him was character. Character includes both an intelligence and vital reaction to life. Character must include some definite beliefs and convictions concerning things that really matter. Jesus himself justified what people thought to be a strange and wonderful teaching by the works he was able to do, and he went further and said, referring to those who study and practice his teachings, "The works that I do, ye shall do, and greater works."
The works that I do, ye shall do, and greater works.
Now what, after all, is a miracle? Those who deny the possibility of miracles on the grounds that the universe is a perfect system of law and order, and to the operation of which there can be no exceptions, are perfectly correct. But the explanation is that the world of which we are normally aware, and with whose worldly laws alone most of us are acquainted, is only a fragment of the whole universe, as it really is. And there is no such thing as appealing from a lower to a higher law, from a lesser to a greater expression. For all things are possible in the consciousness of an unlimited universe. So in the sense that all the ordinary rules and limitations of the physical plane can be set aside or overridden by an understanding of the nature of God, then miracles, in the colloquial sense of the word, can and do happen. Let us suppose, for the sake of example, that on a certain Monday your affairs are in such a condition that, humanly speaking, unpleasant consequences are sure to follow by the end of that week. This could even be a lawsuit or a medical diagnosis of a very serious nature. If you can raise your consciousness above the limitations of the physical plane in connection with this matter, the lawsuit or the health problem can melt away.
To raise our consciousness above the limitations of the physical plane is the scientific description of what is commonly called prayer. If we pray successfully, then the condition on that plane will change, and in some utterly unforeseen and normally impossible manner, the problems in our lives melt away to the advantage of all concerned. In other words, miracles, in the popular sense of the word, can and do happen as a result of prayer. Prayer does change things. Prayer does cause things to happen differently than they would have happened had the prayer not been made. It makes no difference at all what sort of difficulty we are in. It doesn't matter what the causes may have been that led up to it. Enough prayer will get us out of our difficulty if we are only persistent enough in raising our consciousness to a high level. Another way to think of it is to raise your awareness level so that you see the world as perfect, see life without the problem. Prayer is both a science and an art, and it was to the teaching of this science and art that Jesus devoted the greater part of his ministry. The gospel miracles happened because Jesus had the spiritual understanding that gave him the greatest power in prayer.
It is the spiritual key that unlocks the mystery of the Bible teaching in general, and of the Gospels in particular. It is the spiritual key that explains the miracles were performed in order to prove to us that we too can perform miracles and overcome sin, sickness, and limitation. With this key, we can afford to discard verbal inspiration and all superstitious literalism, and understand the Bible in its most precious and most authentic interpretation.
Externally, the Bible is a collection of inspired documents written by men of all kinds in all sorts of circumstances and over hundreds of years of time. The documents, as we have them, are seldom original, but compilations of older fragments, and the names of the actual writers are seldom known. This, however, doesn't affect the spiritual purpose of the Bible in the slightest degree. It is, in fact, quite immaterial. The book, as we have it, is an inexhaustible reservoir of spiritual truth, compiled under divine inspiration, and the actual route by which it reached its present form doesn't matter. Divine wisdom is the author, and that is all that concerns us. History, biography, lyrical, and other poetic forms are various mediums through which the spiritual message is expressed in the Bible. And above all, the parable is used to convey spiritual and metaphysical truth. In some cases, what was never intended to be more than a parable was taken for literal statement of fact. And this often made the Bible seem to teach things that were opposed to common sense. The story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden is a case in point. Rightly understood, this is perhaps the most wonderful parable of all. Adam represents the physical, and Eve the soul or mind. Together they create the whole being. It was never intended by its author to be taken for history, but literal-minded people did so with all sorts of absurd consequences. The spiritual key to the Bible rescues us from all these difficulties, dilemmas, and seeming inconsistencies. It saves us from the false positions of ritualism and fanaticism because it gives us the truth.
And the truth turns out to be nothing less than the amazing but undeniable fact that the whole outer world, whether it be the physical body, the common things in life, the winds and the rain, or the earth itself, is directly related to man's thought, and that we have dominion over thought when we know it. The outer world, far from being the prison of circumstances that it is commonly supposed to be, has actually no character whatsoever of its own, either good or bad. It has only the character that we give to it by our own thinking. It is naturally plastic to our thoughts, and this is so, whether we know it or not, and whether we wish it or not. All day long, the thoughts that occupy your mind, or your secret place, as Jesus calls it, are molding your destiny for good or evil. In fact, the truth is that the whole of your life's experience is but the outer expression of inner thought. Now, we can choose the sort of thoughts that we think about, and it's difficult to break a habit of bad thoughts, but it can be done. Since we choose how we think, we always do choose. Our lives are just the result of the kinds of thoughts we have chosen to hold. They are of our own ordering, and therefore there is a perfect justice in the universe. No suffering for other man's original sin, but the reaping of a harvest that we ourselves have sown. We have free will, but our free will lies in our choice of thought.
Free will lies in our choice of thought.
This is, in essence, what Jesus taught. It is, as we shall see, the underlying message of the whole Bible, but it's not expressed with equal clearness throughout. In the earlier portion of the book, it shines through dimly as the light from a heavily shrouded lamp. But as time goes on, veil after veil is removed, and the light shines ever stronger and stronger, until in the teaching of Jesus Christ, it pours forth clear and unimpeded. Truth never changes, but what we have to deal with on this plane is man's fear of the truth. And throughout historical time, this has been steadily and continuously improving. In fact, what we call progress is merely the outer expression corresponding to mankind's improved awareness of God. Jesus Christ summed up this truth, taught it completely and thoroughly, and above all, demonstrated it in his own person. Most of us can glimpse intellectually the idea of what that must mean in its fullness, and what must inevitably follow from a competent understanding of it. But what we can actually demonstrate or experience in our lives is a very different matter. To accept the truth is the great first step, but not until we have proved it in doing it is it ours. Jesus proved everything that he taught, even overcoming death, in what we call the resurrection. Every time you overcome a difficulty by prayer, you help the whole of the human race, past, present, and future, in a general way. And you help it to overcome that special kind of difficulty in particular. Jesus, by surmounting every sort of limitation to which mankind is subject, in particular by overcoming death, performed a work of unique and immeasurable value for us all, forever, and is therefore justly entitled the Savior of the world.
At what he deemed an opportune moment in his public ministry, Jesus decided to sum up his whole teaching in a series of lectures, extending probably over several days and speaking probably two or three times a day. He took this opportunity to summarize the message, to dot the I's and cross the T's, so to speak. A number of those present naturally took notes, and later on these notes were edited into what we know as the Sermon on the Mount. The authors of the four Gospels each selected the material in accordance with their own purpose, and it is Matthew who gives us the most complete and carefully arranged version of this address. It covers all the essentials. It is practical and personal. It is definite, specific, and widely illuminating. Once the true meaning of the instructions has been grasped, it is then only necessary to put them faithfully into practice in order to get immediate results.
This concludes The Golden Keys to Successful Living.
And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain. And when he was set, his disciples came unto him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you.
The Sermon on the Mount opens with the Eighth Beatitude, one of the best-known sections of the Bible. Even people whose knowledge of the Scriptures is limited have heard of these Beatitudes. However, they hardly ever understand them, and as a rule regard them as a counsel of perfection without any real application. But this is only because they lack the spiritual key, which is the knowledge of how to apply the Scriptures from the spiritual level to everyday life. The Beatitudes are actually a prose poem in 8 verses, which is complete in itself and constitutes a general summary of the whole Christian teaching. It is a spiritual, more than a literary, synopsis, summarizing the spirit of the teaching rather than in literal words. This general summing up is highly characteristic of the ancient Oriental approach to religious and philosophical teaching, and naturally recalls the Eightfold Path of Buddhism, the 10 Commandments of Moses, and other concise groups of ideas.
Jesus concerned himself exclusively with the teaching of general principles, and these general principles always had to do with mental states. For he knew that if one's mental states are right, everything else must be right also. Yet, if these are wrong, nothing else can be right. Unlike other great religious teachers, he gives us no detailed instructions about what we are to do or not to do. He does not tell us either to eat or to drink or to refrain from eating or drinking during specific times or certain seasons. The whole point of his teaching is anti-ritualistic. A conscientious Pharisee of those days, and most of them were extremely conscientious, had approximately 600 outer detailed observances or rituals to attend every day before he could feel that he had satisfied the requirements of God. As it is obvious that no human being could actually carry out this sort of thing in practice, the natural result would be that the victim, conscious of falling far short of the accomplishments of his duties, must necessarily labor under a chronic sense of guilt or sin. Now, to believe yourself to be sinful is, for all practical purposes, to be sinful, with all the consequences that follow. The policy of Jesus is to wean the heart from relying upon outer things at all, either for pleasurable gratification or for spiritual salvation, and to incorporate a new attitude of mind altogether. And this policy is graphically set forth in the Beatitudes. Jesus also made us aware that how we worship God has nothing to do with physically where we are.
The hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. The hour cometh, and now is when the true worshipper shall worship the Father in truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is the Spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth.
Your church, your temple, your place of worship, your secret place of Most High is with you at all times. Now let's examine and reacquaint ourselves with the simple and profound statements known as the Beatitudes.
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
In order to understand what Jesus meant by poor in spirit, we have to take into account a point of great practical importance in the study of the Bible. It is written in a peculiar language of its own, in that terms and expressions and sometimes actual words are used in the Bible in a sense that is distinctly different from that of everyday usage. The Bible is really a textbook of metaphysics, a manual for the growth of the soul, and it looks at all questions from this point of view. Remember, in every sense of the word, it takes the broadest view of every subject. It sees all things in their relationship to the human soul, and it uses many common terms in a far broader sense than their everyday meaning. For example, the word bread in the Bible means not merely any kind of physical food, but all things that man requires. All physical things such as clothing, shelter, money, education, companionship, and so forth. And in relationship to the soul, it stands for spiritual perception, spiritual understanding, and ultimately spiritual realization. Give us this day our daily bread. I am the bread of life. Unless ye eat this bread. These are examples of the many uses of just one word. Another example is the word prosperity. In the scriptural sense, prosperity and prosper mean a great deal more than the acquisition of material possessions. Prosperity means success in prayer. From the point of view of the soul, success in prayer is the only kind of prosperity worth having. And if our prayers are successful, we shall naturally have all the material things that we need. A certain quantity of material goods is essential on this plane, of course, but material wealth, by itself, is really the least important thing in life. And this the Bible implies by giving the word prosperous its true meaning, success in prayer.
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
So to be poor in spirit does not in the least mean the thing we call poor-spirited today. To be poor in spirit means to have emptied yourself of all desire to exercise personal self-will, and to have renounced all preconceived opinions in the wholehearted search of God. It means to be willing to set aside your present habits of thought, your present views and prejudices, your present way of life if necessary, to eliminate, in fact, anything and everything that can stand in the way of finding God. We can reject the guidance that Jesus offers us, reject our chance of finding God, because we are bound by our possessions. And even those who have no material wealth are bound by their own set of great possessions, in the way of preconceived ideas, such as self-satisfaction or reliance upon the way that is familiar or easy, or great possessions of spiritual pride born of intellectual distinction. We even have sentimental or material attachments to institutions, organizations, and relationships, and habits of life that we have no desire to renounce. When the image of ourselves is measured by the world of possessions and attachments, we will always be grounded and seemingly apart from God. Wealth in itself is neither good nor bad, but love of money, the Bible tells us, is the root of all evil.
To be poor in spirit means we can all be multimillionaires in silver and gold. We can have possessions of learning, possessions of public honor and importance. But as long as our hearts are not set upon having these things, we are as free of material attachments as the poorest beggar to enter the kingdom of heaven. The poor in spirit have overcome the love of money and property, the fear of public opinion and the disapproval of relatives and friends. They are no longer overawed by human authority. They are no longer self-satisfied on their own opinions. They have come to see that their most cherished beliefs may have been, and probably were, mistaken, and that all their ideas and views of life may be false and indeed need changing. The poor in spirit are ready to continuously re-examine their lives and learn to live in the kingdom of heaven every day.
Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted.
Mourning or sorrow is not in itself a good thing, for the will of God is that everyone should experience happiness and joyous success. Jesus says, "I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly." Nevertheless, trouble and suffering are often extremely useful, because many people will not bother to learn the truth until driven to do so by sorrow and failure. Sorrow then becomes a relatively good thing. Sooner or later, every human being will discover the truth about God and make their contact with Him at first hand. Sooner or later, we will all have to acquire the understanding of truth, which will set us free once and for all from our three-dimensional limitations and their end results, sin, sickness, and death. But most people won't undertake the search for God wholeheartedly unless driven there by trouble of some kind. There is really no need to have trouble if we only seek God first. Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, then the trouble need never come. We always have the choice of learning by spiritual unfoldment or of learning by painful experience. As a rule, it's only when health is broken down and ordinary medical means have failed to afford relief that people seriously set about gaining that spiritual understanding of their body as the true embodiment of divine life. And this is our only guarantee of overcoming sickness and ultimately death. If we could turn to God for this understanding while our health is still good, we need never be sick at all. Again, it's usually only when people are feeling the pinch of poverty, that is when ordinary material sources of supply have dried up, that they turn to God as a last resort and learn the lesson that the divine power really is the source of man's supply, and all material agents are merely the channels.
Now, this is the lesson to be learned and thoroughly realized before man can pass on to any experience higher or wider than the present one. In our Father's house are many mansions, but the key to higher mansions is always acquiring complete dominion over the one we are in now. If prosperous people will, while they are still prosperous, acknowledge God as their true source and pray daily for still more spiritual understanding, they need never suffer poverty or financial trouble at all. At the same time, they must be careful to use their present resources well, not hoarding riches selfishly or spending foolishly, but recognizing that God is the owner, and that they are only the stewards or trustees for Him. The command of money involves a responsibility which one cannot evade. Dispense it wisely or be prepared to learn some lessons. This general principle applies to every one of our difficulties, not merely physical or financial troubles, but all the other ills to which the flesh is heir. Family troubles, quarrels with friends, sadness, and all the rest need never come if we will seek first the kingdom of God and right understanding. But if we look in another direction for our source of power, then the troubles of life will become our own. And then this sadness will be a blessing in disguise, for through it we shall be comforted. And by comfort, the Bible means the experience of the presence of God, which is the end of all sadness.
Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth.
On the surface, this beatitude seems to have very little validity and seems to be obviously contradicted by the plain facts of everyday life. No sensible person looking about the world or studying history could sincerely accept this saying at its face value. And most honest Christians have passed it by in practice with a regretful feeling that no doubt that is how things ought to be, but realize things aren't that way in real life. The fact is that when correctly understood, the teaching of Jesus is found to be not only true, but exceedingly practical and of value to every situation, every day of our lives. We find then that He was no sentimental dreamer, no mere dealer in empty platitudes, but the unflinching realist that only a great mystic can be. And the whole essence of His teaching and of His practical application is summed up in this beatitude.
Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth.
When you possess the spiritual meaning of this statement, you have the secret of dominion, the secret of overcoming every kind of difficulty. It is literally the key of life. It is the Jesus Christ message reduced to a single sentence.
The words meek and earth are both used in a special and highly technical sense, and they have to be unveiled before the wonderful meaning that underlies them can be found. First of all, the word earth in the Bible does not mean merely this terrestrial globe. It really means manifestation. Manifestation or expression is the result of a cause. A cause has to be expressed or manifested before we can know anything about it. And yet every expression or manifestation has to have a cause. Now we learn in divine metaphysics, and particularly in the Sermon on the Mount, that all causation is mental, and that our body and all our affairs, our home, our business, our personal relationships, all our experiences are the expression of our own mental states. The fact that we are unconscious of most of our mental states doesn't change anything, because the thoughts are there in our subconscious mind and still create or cause our lives to turn out the way they do. Our earth means the whole of our outer experience, and to inherit the earth means to have dominion over that outer experience. That is to say, to have power to bring our conditions of life into harmony and true success. All the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. His soul shall dwell at ease, and his seed or prayers shall inherit the earth. The Lord reigneth, let the earth rejoice. So we see that when the Bible talks about the earth, possessing the earth, governing the earth, making the earth glorious, and so forth, it is referring to the conditions of our lives, from our bodily health outwards to the effect our life has on others. So this beatitude undertakes to tell us how we may possess, govern, and be masters of our own lives and destinies. Dominion, that is, power over the conditions of our lives, is obtained in a certain way and in the most unexpected of all ways, by meekness. The word meekness is also used in a special and technical sense. Its true significance has nothing in common with the meaning it bears in modern English. Many unpleasant qualities in human nature are associated with the meek, suggesting weakness, lack of courage, and self-respect, of no use to oneself or to anyone else. The true significance of the word meek in the Bible is a mental attitude for which there is no single word available. And it's this mental attitude which is the secret of prosperity or success in prayer. It's a combination of open-mindedness, faith in God, and the realization that the will of God for us is always something joyous and interesting and vital, and far better than anything we could think of for ourselves. This state of mind inspires a perfect condition to allow this will of God to come about in whatever way divine wisdom considers to be best, rather than in some particular way that we have chosen for ourselves.
This mental attitude, perhaps complex in analysis, but simple in itself, is the key to dominion or success in prayer. There is no one word for it in common speech, but if we desire to inherit the earth, we must absolutely acquire this meekness. There is a familiar phrase, as meek as Moses, resulting from his extraordinary success in prayer. The example of his life influenced the whole subsequent course of history by his teaching and his deeds. Moses had an open mind, ready to be taught new things and new ways of thinking and working. He didn't reject fresh ideas because they were revolutionary. Like all of us, he wasn't free from faults of character, but he was too aware for intellectual or spiritual pride, and therefore gradually rose above his faults as the new truth worked in his soul. Moses thoroughly understood that to conform completely to the will of God didn't involve any loss or risk, and could only mean a finer and better and more splendid life. He didn't think of it as self-sacrifice, for he knew it to be the highest form of self-glorification in the true and wonderful sense of the word. The self-glorification of the egotist is the vanity that always leads to humiliation. True self-glorification, the glorification that is really glorious, is the glorification of God. The Father in me, he doeth the work. I in thee, and thou in me. Realization of this state of mind and state of being called meekness is the key of life, the secret of overcoming every difficulty in life, the way to inherit the earth.
Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled.
When people awaken to a knowledge of these great truths, they naturally try to incorporate them in their own lives. Realizing the vital importance of righteousness, or the thinking only of harmonious thoughts, they began immediately to put their house in order.
The principle involved is perfectly simple, but unfortunately the doing is anything but easy. The nemesis lies in the extraordinary potency of habit. And habits of thinking are the most subtle in character and the most difficult to break. It is easy, comparatively speaking, to break a physical habit, if one really means business, because action on the physical plane is so much slower and more evident than on the mental plane. In dealing with habits of thought, however, we can't stand back and take a comparatively detached view as we can in contemplating our actions. Our thoughts flow across the stage of consciousness in an unbroken stream and so rapidly that only unceasing vigilance can deal with them. Again, the theater of one's actions is the area of his immediate presence. I can only act where I am. I may cause action or reaction by letter or telephone, or I may press a button and bring about results at a distance. But still, my action happens where I am, and at this present moment of time. In thought, on the contrary, I can range over the whole area of my life, including all the people with whom I have been or am in any way concerned, and I can soar away into the past or into the future with equal ease. We can see how much bigger the task of achieving all-round harmonious thinking or true righteousness is than it first appears. For this reason, many people become discouraged with themselves and either don't try or indulge in a great deal of self-condemnation because they aren't able to quickly change the whole current of thought over the whole area of their lives. Self-condemnation, being essentially negative and therefore unrighteous thought, tends to produce still more trouble in the old vicious circle. If you are not progressing as fast as you wish to, the remedy is to become even more aware of holding only harmonious thoughts. Don't dwell on your mistakes or the slowness of your progress, but claim the presence of God with you all the more. Claim wisdom, claim power, or prosperity in prayer. Have a mental evaluation or a review of your life and see if you are still thinking wrongly in some section or other of your mind. Is there some wrong line of behavior that you still pursue? Is there someone whom you have not yet forgiven? Are you indulging in any kind of political or racial or religious hatred or contempt, disguising itself under a cloak of self-righteousness? Remove the cloak and expose those thoughts in the light of right thinking.
The great law of the universe is just this: that what you think in your mind, you will produce in your experience. As within, so without. You cannot think one thing and produce another. If you want to produce circumstances of harmony and happiness, you must first produce thoughts for harmony and happiness, and then the outer things will follow. If you want health, you must first think health. And remember, thinking health does not mean merely thinking a healthy body. Important that is. But it also includes thinking peace and contentment and goodwill to all. Later on in the sermon, we will learn that destructive emotion is one of the primary causes of disease. If you want spiritual unfoldment and growth in the knowledge of God, you must think spiritual thoughts, God thoughts, and give your attention, which is your life, to God rather than to limitation. If you want material prosperity, you must first think prosperity thoughts and then make a habit of doing so. But the thing that keeps most people poor is the sheer habit of poverty thinking. If you want congenial companionship, if you want to be loved, you must first think thoughts of love and goodwill. Like begets like, is another way of stating the great law, which means that as a man soweth in his unseen thoughts, so shall he reap in that which is seen. All things work together for good to those who love good. Meaning, to love God means to occupy oneself with thoughts of good.
All things work together for good to those who love good.
Is there some kind of jealousy left in your heart? It may be personal or it may be professional. This is a good deal more common than anyone would readily admit. Replace the jealousy with thoughts of love. Are there any sentimental regrets or purposeless yearnings for the impossible? If so, accept a higher mental state through the power of God, for no good thing is out of your reach at this very moment in time and forever. Waste no more time rehashing what is over and done, but make the present and the future a splendid realization of your heart's desire. Is there remorse for mistakes past and gone? Then remember that remorse, distinct from repentance, is merely a form of spiritual pride. To revel in it is to stay apart from the love and forgiveness of God, who says, "Behold, now is the day of salvation. Behold, I make all things new."